Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, with the Egyptian military still firmly in power, the Egyptian revolution is very much a work in progress. The same military we were once told was a friend of democratic activists is reportedly continuing policies of torture, detainment, and censorship. But you wouldn't know this from the reporting of most U.S. media, who seem to lose interest in Egypt after the ouster of Hosni Mubarak. We'll talk about this with independent journalist and Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdel Kaddous. Also on the show, you can tell the labor battles in Wisconsin are still going on because the New York Times' Stephen Greenhouse is leading an article with a union president surfing the rising tide of public sector unions to success and power. Wisconsin protests against Governor Walker's proposals are bringing communities together, but many media approach the story with their same old bag of tricks. The nation's John Nichols addressed the disconnect in a recent speech. We'll hear from him on the New York Times and others. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
As the Libyan intervention drags on and Gaddafi's forces have moved into more densely populated areas, the April 8th New York Times editorial page explained how NATO could shift to urban warfare from the air without risking possibly heavy casualties. Bring in the low-flying planes. The American A-10 and AC-130, the editors explain, quote, can fly slow enough and low enough to let them see and target Colonel Gaddafi's weapons without unduly endangering nearby populations, close quote. The AC-130, a modified transport plane bristling with cannons, has been used in virtually every U.S. war since it debuted in Vietnam. The results? In 2002, an AC-130 attack on a wedding party killed dozens of Afghan civilians and wounded many more, including women and children. Another wedding party was struck in 2008, killing as many as 90 civilians. Other AC-130 strikes on civilians have been reported and protested in Afghanistan. In January 2007, Oxfam reported that at least 70 Somali nomads were killed in a secret operation attempting to kill three al-Qaeda leaders. And in the 2003 siege of Fallujah, the AC-130s caused many civilian deaths. As reported by the British Guardian, a former soldier who served in Fallujah described an AC-130 attack on an apartment building there. Quote, it was the most destructive thing I've seen, before or since, close quote. As Ferris documented over the years, the Times has a history of downplaying such civilian deaths and taking the military's word on the precision of its weapons, which might help explain their faith in such a fatally fallible warplane.
The headline in the April 10th New York Times read, "Violence rises as Israel and Hamas trade blows." The story tells us the trading of blows resulted in 18 deaths. Read further and you find that the dead were all Palestinians in Gaza and that roughly half were civilians and thus not aptly described as members of Hamas. On the Israeli side, one boy was seriously injured. As the Times put it, quote, the Israeli military said that if civilians were hit, it was because militants shot from among them. But the deaths on Friday of 19-year-old Nidal Kuda, who was studying to be a medical secretary, and her mother Naja, 40, outside the southeastern city of Khan Yunis, did not fit that pattern, witnesses said, close quote. How such a lopsided situation could be described by a headline suggesting symmetry goes unexplained, but that same sort of tilting of the scales was found in the next day's Times, where Isabel Kirshner presented a timeline of the current Mideast violence, starting, of course, with the Palestinians. Quote, the most recent escalation began when the military wing of Hamas fired a Cornet anti-tank missile at the school bus from a distance of about 2 miles. It was the first time the group used an advanced laser-guided weapon against a civilian target, close quote. That claim seems to be refuted in the next paragraph, where Kirshner writes, quote, Hamas said the attack was meant to avenge Israel's killing of three of the group's militants on April 2nd, an act that Hamas said violated an earlier ceasefire, close quote. Kirshner doesn't offer any evidence that what Hamas is saying is wrong or explain why her reporting matter-of-factly assumes a different view. Readers are presumably just to understand that for U.S. media, escalations begin when Israel says they do.
Reporter Jonathan Carl did a segment on ABC World News on April 7th that was supposed to clarify the issues in the budget showdown. At one point, he described the Republican attempt to insert a ban on federal funding for Planned Parenthood into the budget bill.
And believe it or not, the issue of abortion could be what causes the government to shut down. Democrats say Republicans are trying to use the funding bill to force new restrictions on abortion rights. But Republicans say they are simply trying to restrict public funding of abortion.
Democrats say, Republicans say. You'd think you could train a parrot to do this kind of reporting, but Carl, who's a graduate, incidentally, of a program designed to place young conservatives in mainstream news outlets, manages to garble the story more than a parrot ever could. The thing is, there's already a ban on federal funding of abortion. All the money going to Planned Parenthood is for non-abortion-related women's health care. So what Democrats are actually saying is that Republicans are targeting access to birth control and other reproductive health services under the pretense that they're against publicly funded abortion. So Carl misrepresents what Democrats say and accurately conveys the GOP line, but doesn't point out that it's inaccurate. Later in the segment, Carl returned to the abortion issue.
Today, House Republicans did pass a bill that would keep the government funded for the next week and fund the Pentagon for the rest of the year. But Democrats say that they will oppose it again, Diane, because it includes restrictions on public funding of abortion.
Note that the inaccurate Republican line is now being presented by Carl as fact. Conservatives really got their money's worth when they placed Jonathan Carl at ABC News.
Popular carnival singer is elected president of Haiti in a landslide, the New York Times declared April 5th, to which anyone familiar with the Haitian electoral process could only say, wow. Yet despite passing reference to the idea that the process bringing Michel Martelly to power was far from error and confusion free, the Times report discourages any fundamental questioning of an election observers, including the Center for Economic and Policy Research, call fatally flawed. The Times story refers, as is evidently required, to international observers' supposed fretting over the return to Haiti of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, because the paper says there was worry that the presence of the former president, popularly elected by Haitians but so despised by U.S. governments they've supported his overthrow twice, might suppress turnout. That's like a bad joke, given that Aristide's Lavalas party, Haiti's most popular, has been excluded from the election, which the story notes only by having Aristide say he regrets the exclusion, which was over a technicality. Nor does the story suggest any lingering concerns about the earlier round of voting, acknowledged to have been somewhat marred by fraud and disarray. After a report by the Organization of American States and pressure from international donors, the paper explains matter-of-factly, quote, Haitian officials removed candidate Jude Celestine from the ballot and replaced him with Mr. Martelly, close quote. That would be Martelly, the landslide winner. As Mark Weisbrot described on this show, the pressure included threats to cut off aid to the country, canceling the visas of people in the government, even credible reports of threats to throw President René Préval out of the country, a la Aristide. Surely such information should have some place in any report on election results. But Times readers would need till the end of a story the next day, further back in the paper, to learn projections of the turnout in Martelly's landslide, which were around 30%.
And finally, the following clip is NBC News anchor David Gregory appearing on the NBC Nightly News on April 9th, explaining how he sees Barack Obama's 2012 campaign strategy.
And I thought what was striking about what the president said, if you listen to his comments made Friday night, he sounded very much like a Republican, talking about the need to cut spending. That's the reelection play here. He wants the American people to know, particularly those independent voters, that he is in line with what a lot of Americans want, which is less government, trimming down the size and the scope of government. He wants to be able to say, look, I brought the sides together, I averted the shutdown, and I'm on board with cutting government spending. That's the message he wants to drive next year.
You could have a good argument about whether Obama is really behaving like a Republican, but the more revealing thing here is that Gregory seems to believe this is a wise political strategy, and he thinks it's wise because he thinks that's what voters want. As we've pointed out before, public opinion polls indicate that voters mostly want someone to do something about jobs. The media believe that the public wants spending cuts, an idea, generally speaking, that is more in line with conservative or Republican ideology. Thus, a Democrat who embraces budget cuts will be portrayed as one doing what the public wants, no matter what the public actually wants. This is, of course, the very same media that will be covering the 2012 election.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
After the ouster of Hosni Mubarak, many U.S. media outlets put aside the Egypt story, only to occasionally refer back to the revolution that happened there in February, almost as if the ruling order had been overturned and replaced by the democratic forces who set the uprising in motion. The truth is very different. The Egyptian struggle continues to produce many compelling stories, even if only a few U.S. news outlets have remained interested. With us to talk about Egypt is Sharif Abdel Kaddous. He's an independent journalist, former producer and correspondent for Democracy Now!, where he reported from Cairo's Tahrir Square. Welcome to Counterspin, Sharif Abdel Kaddous.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Well, let's begin with U.S. media coverage of Egypt since February. Which U.S. news outlets, besides the stellar coverage of Democracy Now!, have been doing a decent job, and which, in your view, have left something to be desired?
I think on the whole, Steve, what's called the U.S. mainstream media has largely dropped the ball since Mubarak's ouster on February 11th. The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces is now running the country. There's a lot of suppression of dissent that is happening. A lot of things going to be pushed for by the democracy movement for this unfinished revolution to really go forward. With regards to the TV networks in this country, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, they have done very, very little coverage since February 11th. In terms of print, the New York Times has had an article here or there covering the latest of what's happening. I think in terms of the main papers, them and the Washington Post have done some good coverage about the suppression of dissent, about the jailing of a blogger recently for publishing something against the military. But overall, I would say, apart from independent media in this country, what's called the corporate media in this country has not done enough. Another important point that's being missed by the corporate media is the issue of foreign debt. Egypt owes $3.3 billion to the United States. This is a debt that many Egyptians feel is not valid because it was made under a dictatorship. And there's been a very healthy grassroots campaign to try and have the U.S. forgive that debt. It doesn't look like it will happen. Some lawmakers like Dianne Feinstein said we're in a budget crisis ourselves. We'll have to look at this. But I think it's important to do this in the context of the $1.3 billion in military aid that is sent every year to Egypt, which shores up the military generals, whereas people are looking for debt relief that was owed under an autocrat, which they should not be accountable for.
One of the great tropes in corporate U.S. coverage had been that the Egyptian military was a liberal force, more or less on the side of demonstrators. Tell me what we know about that now.
Well, I think the evidence lays the lie to that claim bare. Because the military, since February 11th, since taking power, has jailed hundreds of activists, of demonstrators. There's clear evidence of torture. Hundreds of people have been sentenced, civilians have been sentenced in military tribunals. There's just recently a new requirement by the Egyptian military that local print media obtain approval from the armed forces before publication. The Committee to Protect Journalists calls it the single worst setback for press freedom in Egypt. They recently jailed a blogger for writing against the military, also in a military tribunal. And they've cracked down on the demonstrations just this past Friday, killing two people, arresting hundreds, and wounding 70. So I think the military, these are not Democrats by any means. These are the same ruling generals that have ruled Egypt, have been the backbone of power in Egypt for Mubarak's entire reign. The military really has been the most important institution in Egypt since 1952 when Gamal Abdel Nasser staged the national coup d'etat against the pro-British monarch, King Farouk. So at its worst, some people say that the Mubarak regime has not collapsed yet. The civilian wing of the Mubarak regime has, but the military wing has not. And there's still a lot to go forward in terms of reaching real reform in Egypt. And I think the military will be the big obstacle to that reform.
You know, on the issue of U.S. media losing interest in the Egypt story after Mubarak's ouster in February, seeing how U.S. media often march in lockstep with U.S. government strategists, I can't help but think that one reason U.S. media walked away from Egypt after Mubarak was out was that with their old pals in the military still in power, you know, a force they see as a stabilizing force, at least for a moment, U.S. policymakers were less nervous, and perhaps the media is in some way reflecting that.
Well, Well, I think, Steve, this is a problem that's endemic with the corporate mainstream media in this country, that they do walk lockstep in power. If you look at the beginning of this revolution, the first statement by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was the Mubarak regime is stable, which was, you know, an implicit sign of support for the Mubarak regime. And you saw that echoed in the mainstream media where they would say, well, the demonstrators say this, but the Mubarak government says this. But as the revolution progressed, and the Obama administration was forced to pay lip service to the revolution, you saw the mainstream media coverage changing as well in support of the revolution. And I think now we've seen from the Obama administration trying to shore up its ties with the military. They've sent the commander of CENTCOM, James Mattis, to meet with Field Marshal Hossein Tantawi, who's the head of the Supreme Council. And I think the media, corporate media, has again followed in lockstep and has not been, on the most part, critical enough of these ruling generals.
I wanted to ask you about one thing. David Ignatius is an important columnist for The Washington Post. He writes about national security issues. And he wrote a recent column suggesting that three prominent figures in Egypt were the founding fathers of the new Egypt. He named Amr Moussa, Mohammed el-Baradei, and Naqib Sawiris. What do you have to say about that? Is this, I mean, he does point out that none of them were in the vanguard at Tahrir Square, although I think he says that they all visited once or twice.
Well, look, I think anyone who is looking for real change in Egypt, Amr Moussa is not their man. Amr Moussa was Mubarak's foreign secretary for 10 years, from 1991 to 2001. He served in the Mubarak government for over 20 years. He's tied with the elite of Egypt. He has made some statements against Israel, which have made him popular, but by no means for people looking for real change, Amr Moussa one of them. A reform advocate, Mohammed el-Baradei, is an important figure. I think we'll have to see going forward what his role will be, but he's been calling for, I think, very good reforms going forward in Egypt. But he doesn't have the popular support that many would hope he has. And as for Naqib Sawiris, he is Egypt's richest businessman. He's a telecommunications tycoon. He just formed a new party. This is certainly not a grassroots or popular figure. So I would dispute that characterization that those are the founding fathers of New Egypt. The founding fathers and mothers of the New Egypt were the young revolutionaries who led this popular uprising.
We've been speaking with Sharif Abdelkaddous, an independent journalist and correspondent for Democracy Now! Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Sharif Abdelkaddous.
Thank you very much, Steve. Glad to be on.
The massive and sustained public pushback against Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's anti-labor and anti-poor and anti-woman plans has heartened many people across the country. But it's clearly startled and confused the corporate press corps. The protests and public support for them undermine elite media narratives of long standing, like the one expressed a few weeks back in Time magazine that, quote, "Since the beginning, Americans have resented government workers asking for money," close quote. At the recent National Conference for Media Reform, the nation's John Nichols, also associate editor of Wisconsin's Capital Times, talked about the gap between the press and the people on the Wisconsin protests. Here's John Nichols.
Everything about the way that major media has covered the Wisconsin struggle is rooted in assumptions about the labor movement and about the support that people give to the labor movement. And it's two very simple assumptions. One, the labor movement is a dinosaur waiting to die, you know, and two, the American people are out there with pitchforks and guns and whatever else trying to kill it. Because we hate labor, and we hate unions, and we hate collective bargaining, we despise. You know, man, if you've got a blue collar, we hate you. You know, and so, I mean, it's a very simple equation. We all know what's going on. This is what all of our media tells us again and again. We only sort of like labor if it's, you know, someplace, you know, maybe in Egypt. You know, labor union in Egypt, that's kind of cool. They come out, that's okay. Foreign country, labor rights, yes, labor rights are human rights in other countries. But America, So... That's, you get those concepts. And then, through two quick little interventions here. See, keep it, I'm not beating on the New York Times. The New York Times is just, the only reason I talk about the New York Times is because everybody talks about Fox and Rush Limbaugh. If Fox and Rush Limbaugh didn't exist, we'd still have exactly the same problem that we have. because it is not Fox and Rush Limbaugh that make the New York Times misreport labor. It is assumptions based on the think tanks and all the operations of the political right, frankly, and corporate America that makes this happen. It is not just conservative media. So the New York Times came out, and they sent a reporter out to cover this labor struggle. Oh, fabulous. Great. Good. It's always good to have somebody from the Times, huh? In fact, they had two of them out, and it was public employees, right? And so they, of course, went for the essential story, because they knew it to be true. The people hate public employees, right? We hate our teachers. We hate the people that plow our roads when it snows. We hate the people that pick up our garbage. We hate the people that, if we get sick, take care of us in the hospital. We despise these people. So it once the public employees are out there protesting, it was just, you know, snap the fingers. Go find some private workers who hate public employees. No problem at all. The New York Times went down to Janesville, Wisconsin, a deindustrialized factory town where the GM plant had recently closed. They went to a bar because, of course, all workers drink. And they just go sit down at the bar, and there they find a worker, and seemingly a blue collar, I assume. Would you display? You have a blue collar here, ma'am? And you show it that there is a blue collar. And I assume the New York Times reporter, having, you know, they had probably had, you know, translators and stuff so they could speak to a working class person. And just speak in a loud, slow voice. Are you from here? Do you work with your hands? Noble laborer. And the noble laborer said, "Why, yes, I do work with my hands. I'm a former auto worker here in town, former union member, and I hate those public employees. They're just horrible. They get great pensions and great pay. I'm not jealous of them. I just hate them." And so the New York Times put it on the front page. Private sector workers think public workers are lazy, fat, and have great pensions. They come across Lake Mendota and Madison on their yachts to do their 2 hours of work and then pick up their paycheck and then head back to their mansions. And they are despised by the working people of Wisconsin. And this went on the front page of the New York Times. Why this is important is the governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, got a call one day from a blogger known as The Beast. Ian Murphy lives in upstate New York. The blogger known as The Beast was going to call Scott Walker. He was going to pretend to be Hosni Mubarak, giving him a call of solidarity, saying, "Stand up, don't let him push you out." I'm not kidding, I interviewed the guy. And he said, "But I couldn't get the Egyptian accent down. So when I called, I thought, whose call would Scott Walker take?" And, oh, David Koch, the billionaire Koch brother guy who funds the Tea Party movement. And so, not kidding, Koch gets the governor's office, and the governor's secretary says, "David Koch on line one." Governor picks up. And as many of you know, the call was recorded. The governor, thinking he was talking to a billionaire campaign contributor, and in the middle of the call, this guy, playing David Koch, says, "Well, how are things going out there?" And he says, "Well, the press coverage is pretty good. There was just a New York Times article that was great. It went on the front page. They said private sector workers hate public sector workers. And I'm photocopying that and handing it out to everybody." Well, you know, the front page of the Times had that article. What was funny was the correction appeared inside, only about two lines, which said, "The worker interviewed in Janesville didn't work at the auto factory, and he wasn't a member of the United Auto Workers, and we spelled his name wrong." They got everything wrong. And the following Saturday, from when that story appeared, the factory workers from Janesville, United Auto Workers Local 95, formed a mass contingent in the march supporting the public workers at the Capitol. So let me bring us around full circle here. Once all these things had happened, the New York Times decided to do an incredible thing, and this other media too. They went out and they polled. They said, "What do you think of labor unions and workers?" They asked the American people. And the poll came back and it showed, well, 70-80% of the American people like unions. 65-70% of the people like collective bargaining. Great majorities like public employee unions and teacher unions. And they're like, the New York Times people go, "Well, it must be a polling error. So there's a glitch here." Then seriously, people thought there's got to be something wrong. And then Time magazine went out, did the same poll, got the same results. Again, there must be a polling error. Something must be wrong. Then they asked the pollster, and the pollster said, well, I think I've got the problem here. We haven't polled on labor in 30 years. We haven't asked anybody what they actually thought about labor unions and collective bargaining and public employee unions, and so we didn't really have a very good baseline on this. And what was the baseline for the last 30 years? The baseline for the last 30 years was spin. It was fantasy. It was a lie. And our media, not just the New York Times, certainly not just Fox and Rush Limbaugh, the whole of our media, our mainstream media system, accepted the lie, incorporated the lie into all its coverage, and created the fantasy that Americans don't like unions, that Americans don't like teachers in particular, think they're paid too much. All the things that you've heard, they're all false. They were never real, and yet they existed as an absolute truth in our media. Why did they exist as an absolute truth in our media? Because for the last 30 years, in fact, honestly, for the better part of the last 60 years, we have been in a steady decline in labor coverage in this country. In 1940, we had more than 1,000 labor reporters covering unions in this country. Today, on major media outlets, we have at best 5. It is an absolute culling out and a denial of a beat. When unions are on strike, they don't even mention the names of our unions. They say the unions are out there. Can you imagine if they were writing a story about GM or Boeing or any company and they said the companies are making profits? No, they name the companies. Why won't they even name the unions? The answer is they have neglected us. They have denied us. They have been totally dysfunctional and disreputable in their approach to the trade union movement. And finally, the people of Wisconsin have come to the streets, and the people of Indiana are in the streets, and the people of Ohio are in the streets, and the people of Michigan are in the streets, and the people of Maine are in the streets saying, you are wrong, and we are coming to prove to you that the American people stand on the side of the labor movement, not the side of a lying press. Thank you.
That was John Nichols of The Nation magazine and The Capital Times, speaking at the recent National Conference for Media Reform in Boston. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.